I'll briefly go through this outline first of all. This is a thematic and historical introduction to Hindu traditions. And this week we'll be raising the problem of what is Hinduism, if there is such a thing, if we can talk about a meaningful entity called Hinduism. And then in the following weeks, I'll be discussing key concepts and themes that arise in the history of Hindu traditions in a thematic and historical way. So next week we'll be looking at the Veda and Vedic traditions, and then we'll be looking at Dharma, society and gender. We'll be then moving on to ascetic traditions, and following on from that, 2 weeks of theistic traditions, followed by a session on local traditions, particularly focusing on Kerala, where I've done some work, and ending up with Hinduism and modernity. So that's the sort of syllabus that covers more or less, I think, the material covered in the exam that some of you will have to take in May or June. And next term's work can be more specific, I think, and we'll go into some of this material in more depth. So we'll be going backwards and forwards in history a bit, but I'm afraid I think that's inevitable when discussing the history of Hinduism in a kind of thematic way. So here's the schedule. You've got a summary of what I intend to say in each of the lectures in the handout here. Whether I stick to that, I don't know. It depends. And I've got a list of readings for each of the sessions, if you're interested to follow any of that up. I also have readings of specific texts in translation that I want to focus on during the lectures from time to time. And I shall start to hand these round as well. I think I'll do that at the end. So I think it's fairly self-explanatory, but there's a text in translation for you to read for each session, and some secondary sources for you to chase up any of the material that you're particularly interested in. So some of these bibliographies are quite long. I don't know what level you're at, whether you know anything about Hinduism or not. I'm assuming no knowledge of Hinduism. So this course is intended primarily for students in theology who don't have any background in Indian traditions. So if you've got a DPhil in Hindu traditions, then you'll be bored probably. And so that's that. Oh, well, there's also a general bibliography at the end for you to follow up anything of particular interest. Right, what is Hinduism? Well, Hinduism is a term denoting the religions or the traditions of the people in India and Nepal who refer to themselves as Hindu, at least in the contemporary context. And it has a number of adherents in other continents as well. And within what we call Hinduism, there's a great variety of beliefs and practices, many of which seem to contradict each other. So, for example, on the one hand, Hinduism might be said to be very world-affirming in its insistence on fulfilling your social duty and your roles as parent and citizens, and social actor, as it were. And yet on the other, it might be said to be world-denying in that it claims in advocating renunciation of social roles in the pursuit of a higher good or a higher of liberation from the world. And again, many Hindus are vegetarian, yet in many places sacrifice is offered to ferocious goddesses, and many Hindus are not vegetarian indeed. Many Hindus believe in reincarnation, but others do not. In Kerala, about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I was talking with my colleague Rich Freeman. We were talking to this old lady, and we were asking her, what happens when you die? And she says, well, part of you goes into the ground, part of you goes to heaven, and part of you becomes a crow. So, then this was a kind of popular level of popular conception of what happens to a person. So the belief in reincarnation, although it's mainly from in the Brahmanical tradition that is held at a lower caste, if you like, level or popular level, it's not a universal belief, as it were. So we'll be looking. So anyway, you seem to have these apparent contradictions, and which is why Wendy Doniger, or Wendy O'Flaherty, refers to Hinduism as a religion of fire and ice. So when we speak about Hinduism, are we dealing with a single religion or an essence manifested in different forms, or is Hinduism a diversity of distinct traditions sharing certain common features but with no single feature shared by them all? Are we therefore dealing with a fragmented cultural reality of widely diverse beliefs and practices, inappropriately classified as single religion? So that's the kind of question that I want to look at. So the question, what is Hinduism, is a complex one, the answer to which ranges from claiming that Hinduism is a unified, coherent field of doctrine and practices, to claiming that Hinduism is a fiction, a colonial construction based on a miscategorization of indigenous forms of culture. So those are the kind of two broad positions. So the debate about what is Hinduism is not simply an academic exercise, but is closely connected to the question of who speaks for Hinduism, or who speaks for Hindus. A question which, of course, goes beyond the academy and reaches into the contemporary politics of representation in contemporary India and elsewhere. So in the coming weeks, you'll have the opportunity to form your own judgments about what Hinduism is and to critically assess the different arguments and positions. So let's begin with the term itself. The word Hindu comes from the Persian word Hind, or the Arabic Al-Hind, for the area of the Indus Valley. I was looking for a map this morning of India, but I couldn't find one on the page. This word is in turn derived from a Persian Sindhu, meaning river or ocean, and its earliest uses are in the 8th century, when Persian authors made a distinction between the Muslims and the non-Muslim Hindus. And this use continued, and later Sanskrit sources indicate that it was used by Hindus themselves as early as the 15th century. So the argument that Hinduism is a construction made up in the 19th century, you can actually trace the use of the word by people who want to distinguish themselves from the Yavanas, from the Muslims, as early as the 15th century in Kashmir, which is quite an early use of the term. And there it could be that the word Hindu indicates, as distinct from the Yavanas, the Muslims, a range of cultural practices that are shared by this group of people. So it probably indicates like cremation of the dead, veneration of the cow, certain shared kind of cuisine perhaps. And it might well include Jains and Buddhists, we don't know. So that's quite an early use. It also occurs in Bengal, where again, in the 16th century, where it's used to separate the Hindus from the Yavanas again. Now, towards the end of the 18th century, Hindu, in English with two O's at the end, Hindu is used by the British to refer to the people of Hindustan, an area northwest South Asia, who were not Muslims, Sikhs or Jains. And the ism was added in the 19th century. Dermot Killingly says it was added by Ram Mohan Roy in 1819, but I haven't checked that out, but certainly it was in use by 1840. And it became widely used in the 19th century, particularly as a flag to identify the religion of the indigenous people of India, in contrast to the colonialists' Christianity. And that Hinduism, indeed, was just as good, if not better, than Christianity. So it became linked in to inspiring, to a people aspiring for nationhood, and to throw off the shackles of colonialism. Now, since Indian independence, the term Hindu has taken on a strongly political connotation, and being Hindu comes to be identified in some quarters in India with being Indian, and we'll be looking at that more closely presently. So some scholars argue then that Hinduism is a misnomer, wrongly classifying a number of distinct religions under the same category. So Thomas Stiesenkron is a good example of this in that book, Hinduism Redefined. What is it? Hinduism? I can't remember the title now. The volume edited by Kulka. Do you remember what it's?
Reconsidered.
Hinduism Reconsidered, yes. And others argue that the problem lies in the use of the category religion in a South Asian context. Religion, the argument goes, is a term that has developed in the history of Christianity since the 17th century and has entailed the distinction between religion and politics. So John Locke, after the 30 years of religious war in Europe, says, well, let's separate out religion from politics. Religion we put into the realm of privacy, into the private realm, and governance is in the public realm. So he wanted to separate out the two. And some scholars argue, like Tim Fitzgerald, my colleague at Stirling, argues that distinction is entailed in our modern concept of religion, and that we misappropriately apply that to a South Asian context. And that distinction does not exist there. And indeed, the very category of religion, which assumes a primacy of belief over practice, is inappropriately used in a South Asian context. So that's in Fitzgerald's broad argument. The Western notion of religion not only assumes the primacy of belief over practice, but also assumes that a person can only belong to one religion rather than another. Now, by contrast, you might argue that in South Asia, people might do puja to Vishnu and also do pay homage to the tomb of a Muslim saint, which they do. So the category of religion, it might be argued, stems from, So the category of religion in a South Asian context is problematic. That's the point I want to make. And people like Fitzgerald argue that it's a completely inappropriate term to use in the context of India. But in spite of these criticisms, there are Hindu analogues to the categories that we associate with religion, to the categories of revelation, tradition, theology and practice. Indeed, we might say that Hinduism contains both uniting and dispersing tendencies, both centrifugal and centripetal forces within it. It could be argued that although modern Hinduism has very diverse historical roots, being derived from a number of traditions, there are nevertheless uniting themes that cut across those traditions at a number of levels, such as pilgrimage, a shared pattern of worship, along with shared philosophical concerns and theological concerns. We might claim that the uniting and separating tendencies of Hinduism operate in broadly three levels through history. Now, you could disagree with this, but this is a good place to start, I think. First of all, the Brahmanical Sanskritic tradition, and secondly, regional traditions, and thirdly, trans-regional narrative traditions, which I've outlined on that sheet there. So I'm going to go through each of those in turn. So the Brahmanical Sanskritic tradition. By this, I mean primarily traditions of reflection and philosophical commentary developed from an early age in the history of Hinduism. The medium is broadly Sanskrit, and the upholders of the tradition are Brahmins or Brahmans. It's the different English spellings of the Sanskrit term. Many of these philosophical traditions developed in response to the Veda, which some have argued is central to our understanding of Hinduism, and all traditions respond to it. For those of you who are completely new to the Hinduism, the Veda, the word means knowledge, and it refers to the sacred texts of Hinduism, the revelation of the Hindu revelation, as it were, which are believed I'll defer a discussion of the Veda till next time. Okay, so some Hindus then claim that the Veda is central to our understanding of Hinduism. And you could argue that all the traditions respond to it. So there's a scholar in the States, Smith, I can't remember his first name.
Brian Smith,
yeah, argues that you have to understand Hinduism with reference to the Veda. And that's a meaningful way of speaking about it. I'm very sympathetic to that, really, that Hindus respond to the Veda in some way. So it's a constraint, if you like, upon the traditions. Yes, some have argued then that it's central to our understanding of Hinduism and all traditions respond to it, offering different interpretations of it. Some claiming that it's all about, what the Veda is about action and ritual, about injunction, and some claiming that it's about knowledge and understanding and wisdom. Some later traditions claim that actually the Veda is a lower revelation that paved the way, as it were, for the higher revelation of the tantric traditions, of the Tantras. And some have wholly rejected it, and you could claim that those who wholly reject the Veda are then placing themselves outside of the Hindu fold, outside of the Hindu tradition. And I think that's a fair way of looking at this. If Hinduism means anything, if we're going to use the term meaningfully, we could argue that it has meaning in reference to the Veda and the traditions that respond to the Veda in a positive way. Now, by the early centuries of the Common Era, the Sanskritic Brahmanic or tradition had clearly defined boundaries of philosophical and theological positions within it. So it's not a homogenous thing. There are lots of different traditions within it, but they all respond to the Veda in some way. And they all write in the medium of Sanskrit, and so there's a sort of cosmopolitanism, as what Sheldon Pollock has called the Sanskrit cosmopolis develops in the medieval period, when Sanskrit is the shared language, a bit like Latin in European, in medieval Europe. Now, it is from this tradition, or this range of traditions, through which Hinduism has been, until recently, known in the West. So in order for you to begin to get a handle, or get a grasp of what Hinduism is, I thought I briefly describe some key concepts, which are not universal in Hinduism, but nevertheless very pervasive. I apologise for those of you who know all about this, but this is for people who are coming to this call, as it were, really. So you've got karma and reincarnation is the first concept that the coming out of the Brahmanic or Sanskrit tradition. The key ideas, karma, samsara, moksha, dharma, bhakti and yoga. So many Hindus believe in reincarnation. One's place, and it's certainly a trope, if you like, or a theme in the Sanskritic Brahmanical tradition. And one's place in the social order and the natural order of the universe. We're born over and over again into a particular realm of the universe, depending on our actions, our karma. Now, the word karma means action. A significant action. Richard Gombrich described it the other day. So scratching your nose isn't karma, but getting married would be. And originally it referred to ritual action. So we'll be looking at this more next week. So the giving up of getting rid of karma is linked in historically to the renunciation of ritual action in order for to seek liberation for a higher cause or for a different reason. So karma means action. It particularly originally referred to ritual action, but came to have an extended semantic field to more than just ritual action. And it became to refer to the cycle of cause and effect with regard to action, so that all actions have a consequence at a later time. And there are debates about how that can be, where are the effects of these actions stored, as it were, that have effects later on. And there were debates with the Buddhists about this. So everything you do, both good and bad, has a reaction back on you at some later date in this and another lifetime. There's also the idea that some karma can be transferred to others. and which we'll probably come across when we look at the theistic traditions particularly. So you're there's this idea of an essence in all beings which is reincarnated over and over again depending on its actions, and liberation is freedom from that cycle of suffering. Yes, the other thing one should say is that is associated with suffering. This cycle of birth and death is associated with suffering, as it was for the other non-Hindu traditions such as the Buddhists and the Jains. And moksha, liberation, is freedom from this entanglement. But how this is conceptualized, these are very bare building blocks. How these are conceptualized and thematized in the history of traditions varies greatly, as we'll see. A third very important concept is, fourth one, is dharma. Now this is linked to four goals of life. I was talking to somebody once, what is a Hindu, and he said, a Hindu is somebody who has four, believes that life has four purposes. Dharma, gaining wealth, and having fun, pleasure. The four goals of life, dharma, artha, and karma. And the fourth goal of life is moksha, liberation. So worldly success. So dharma means duty in this context, duty to your, and social responsibility, duty to your family and society, and social responsibility. Outer is wealth or worldly success. Pleasure, karma, particularly sexual pleasure, but also aesthetic pleasure, is contained within that category. Everyone's heard of the Kama Sutra, the Kama Shastra. There's also Arta Shastra, and there's Dharma Sutras and Dharma Shastra as well. So there are philosophical commentaries on all of these kind of areas, as it were, Sanskrit literature on all of these areas. And liberation, which is in some ways counter to those world-affirming values. So if social duty, pleasure, and success are world-affirming values, some argue that liberation is actually opposed to those values, is a higher value than those world-affirming values. There's a big debate in Hinduism about this. Some argue that karma is the most important value because that's what drives the universe, that drives everything on. Some argue that artha is the most important value, but generally dharma is regarded as perhaps the most important. But some say there's a higher dharma, which is liberation from the cycle of rebirth. Now, dharma is untranslatable. It's the nearest Sanskrit equivalent to the term religion, perhaps, but it also embraces the meanings of duty, law, both religious, legal, and natural, truth, and teachings. So it has a wide semantic range. So the dharma of birds to fly is the dharma of birds to fly, the dharma of grass to grow. The dharma of humans to think and seek liberation. Now one might define an orthodox Hindu, if you like, as one who follows the dharma as revealed by in the Veda. And more specifically, dharma refers to a Hindu's position in the social hierarchy. Some argue that, well, this is particularly in the 19th century, that caste was essential to Hinduism. The notion of caste was essential to Hinduism. But we'll be looking at this in week three or four. But generally scholars move away from that these days. So traditionally in the Veda, there's a hymn in the Rig Veda which describes a giant person, the Purusha, who is sacrificed to the gods, and the different classes of society come out of his body. So the Brahmins, who are the voice of society, come out of his mouth. The warriors come out of his shoulders, the strength of society. The merchants and commoners come out of his thighs, the support of his society. And the Shudras, the serfs, come out of his feet. I suppose those upon whom the rest of the social body stands. Now, there's some debate about this, whether that is the origin of the caste system, as we understand it now, or not. So we'll be looking at that more closely in week four. So you could argue that an orthodox Hindu will follow Varnashrama Dharma, which is your dharma with regard to your varna, your class, and with regard to your stage of life, your ashrama. And we'll be looking at that in week three. Okay, a fifth concept is bhakti, devotion, which is important, that comes out of this tradition. Devotion to particular deities, particularly in iconic form. And yoga as a method, a means of gaining liberation, freedom from samsara. So those are key ideas that you should, which are, if you like, handles for you to understand in order to get a grip on the history of Hindu traditions, which develop within this Brahmanical Sanskritic tradition. Moving on to regional traditions then. Regional traditions are very extremely important in the development of Hinduism. And you could even say that village traditions as well are important. So the region or the village. Fred Hardy advocated this idea that the region is key in understanding Hinduism. And these local or regional traditions have strongly influenced the Sanskritic Brahmanical tradition. And the Brahmanical tradition in turn influences the regional tradition. So you get this two-way effect, this two-way relationship. And these regional traditions are often focused on local deities, often ferocious goddesses at a village level. And local deities often become identified with trans-regional gods of the Sanskrit Brahmanical tradition. And this is a process called Sanskritization that I'll be talking about in due course. And a key practice in the regional traditions is puja, making an offering to a deity and receiving a blessing. So in the Gita, I can't remember the passage, I'm sure some of you will know it, Krishna says that you offer him a flower or a leaf or, do you remember it, Ken?
Fruit. Water.
Yes. And that's an offering, it's a puja in a way. Or you can have a very elaborate puja. But the basic, I think the basic structure is offering something and receiving a blessing in return. So it's this twofold reciprocation. Making an offering to a form of the deity and receiving a blessing. And there are a number of remarks that we need to make about this level of the tradition, particularly the centrality of the icon or the image or the idol from the 19th century. Murti, form, body, vigraha, body, bimba, image, mirror, wasn't it? Mirror. Deity, did somebody say? Yeah. And consciousness of the deity is brought down into the image by the. Let me take one example. In Kerala, there are the class of Brahmin priests called Tantris who. Enliven the icons through bringing the consciousness of the deity into them through a ritual process. In fact, the priest evokes the deity into his own body and then takes the body out, takes the consciousness or the shakti of the deity, the power of the deity, out from his heart through the crown of his head and places it into the icon of the deity in the temple, and thereby enlivens the deity, or painting the eyes and opening the eyes of the deity in other areas. So the icon is regarded as a manifestation or indeed an emanation of the deity, or indeed of a single all-pervading transcendent being, and the deity receives gifts as an honoured guest and gives blessings in return. So people this is also a practical side to this. People will offer pujas for a particular reason, or take a vow of ratam in South India for a certain, say for their daughter or son to be married or whatever, or success in a particular area of life. And generally, there is this idea that the deity emanates or manifests as the icon. But that's not universal. So again, referring to our old lady in Kerala, when asked about whether this goddess called Bhagavati in this particular village with a shrine was the same as the Bhagavati 2 miles ago with the same name with the, in the shrine. And she was puzzled and said, no, this one is here and that one's over there. So, I mean, at that level, she didn't have that, she couldn't understand this idea of emanation. Or so at a popular level, these deities are indeed distinct. But you are somebody else, and he would say, well, yes, they're both manifestations of emanations of the goddess or whatever. Another important idea and practice at regional and local level is possession, avesha, which is all pervasive practice, or occurrence rather, at village level. And it could be the model for the divinization of the icon. My colleague Rich Freeman argues this, an anthropologist. But the divinization of the self, or indeed the divinization of the self, could be modelled, he argues, on the notion of possession, of God entering the person. So the possessed person becomes a walking icon or image. So the word possession in English has a negative connotation, but in village India, it's a blessing to become possessed on certain occasions by the god or the goddess. And you become a walking icon. So the Teyam traditions in Kerala that we'll be looking at in a few weeks, the dancer becomes possessed by the goddess and bestows her darshan, the vision upon the people. The people can see the goddess and receive a blessing in that way. There's also bad possession through illness, such as illness or madness or social calamity of some kind, which is attributed to a bad possession. So possession is very important and is at this village and folk level. And we'll be looking at that in week 7, I think. Right, so moving on rapidly, we've got trans-regional narrative traditions. Now, stories are all pervasive in Hinduism. There's lots of stories, and they're all pervasive in the traditions. And these became established in pan-Indic texts, particularly the epics and Puranas. Itihasa Purana. And they're generally in Sanskrit, although there are, of course, regional traditions in vernacular languages, such as particularly Tamil is particularly important here. And two important narrative traditions in Sanskrit are the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and vast collections of ancient stories, the Puranas, the ancient texts. And these narratives reflect the rise of devotion and a concern with the restoration of dharma, restoration of righteousness, and are also often concerned with kings and warriors and reflect an important or martial or warrior dimension in the history of Hinduism. But the Sanskrit narrative tradition shouldn't hide the importance of regional languages, particularly Tamil, but also Malayalam and Kerala. So I'll be talking about that when we look at Hindu theistic traditions. So those three levels, if you like, the Brahmanical Sanskrit tradition, regional traditions, and trans-regional narrative traditions, are ways into the history of Hinduism. They're not set in stone, but they're my kind of way of reading the tradition, which I hope makes some sense. Now, moving on to political essentialism, going back to our debate that we opened up at the very beginning, because of this diversity, some have disparaged the view that Hinduism is a single religion, as I said earlier, such as Tim Fitzgerald. But the term is here to stay, and Hindu has become charged with cultural and political meanings in the modern world. It arouses strong feelings when its integrity is apparently threatened. For example, by the controversial claim that Hindus have been beef eaters in their history, a book by Jar a few years ago, or in the work of Corksite on Ganesh that caused a stir last year, although the book was written about 20 years ago. So Hinduism, then, is part of the cultural politics of India, And the term Hindu is highly politicized as a sign which gathers around which to gather the hopes and aspirations of major sections of Indian society. Now, one important strand has been that India is united by Hindu culture, and that Hinduness, or Hindutva, is a political force that can unite all Hindus against the threatening others, against foreign forces, as it were. And we might call this a political essentialism, in that it sees Hinduism as part of the nation's ideology, which is a living entity going back thousands of years. Hinduism is no construct of Western scholarship on this view. Such expressions are found in the laudation of deities such as Rama, who comes to express Hindu nationalist aspirations. So it's a warrior ethos. Now, to be effective, an ideology has to appeal to people's real needs and real concerns. And clearly the Hindutva idea does appeal to many people's real concerns. But is arguably alien to the spirit of Hindu traditions, which have always been multifaceted and plural. On Julius Lintner's account of Hinduism, it's perfectly feasible to be a Christian and a Hindu, but such a hybridity is generally excluded from Hindutva claims, although you might want to disagree with that. And the Hindutva, the political essentialism, is also linked to a historical claim that Hinduism is an ancient religion that goes back many thousands of years, right back to the Indus Valley and before. And so it's antithetical to much modern scholarship, which claims that it is in fact a more recent construction. We do have time to go into this. Seeing I don't have a map of India, I'm going to draw one. Do you think this will rub off if I write?
Yes, I think so.
Yes.
That's
right. Yeah. Dry white, yeah. So that's India. We've got two rivers in here. You've got the River Indus there and the River Ganges there, and you've got mountains up there and the mountains there. And all cultural forces tend to come into India from the north or northwest. And it's a bit like a pressure cooker. Everything goes in and gets boiled up together and nothing kind of really escapes. And you could say that Hinduism is a fusion of two cultural spheres, a Dravidian cultural sphere, i.e. Dravidian languages in the south, and Indo-Aryan languages in the north. And that Hinduism, part of the contradiction that I spoke about at the beginning, are due to the fusion of these two cultural areas or cultural groups. I'm just making this up on the spot, so bear with me. the political essentialists argued, well, so let's go back a bit. Here is the River Indus. There was a civilization was discovered along the River Indus, the Harappan civilization or Indus Valley civilization. It has a script although there's some controversy about whether it is a script or not, but there are these great cities which are akin to Mesopotamia. Ascoparpola, in his wonderful book Deciphering the Indus Script, shows how the links between the Indus Valley civilization and Mesopotamia. And it was a vast civilization that extended from Gujarat right over here to the Punjab and right up into the north there. Now, we don't know much about it. By the 2000 BC, it was in decline, possibly through over-farming in the Indus Valley region. The argument was that you had these people here who spoke a Dravidian language, and then from the north, a group of people calling themselves the Aryans came in, the noble ones speaking the perfect language, Sanskrit. And they colonised this area in the north and eventually colonised the whole of the north of India, which became the homeland of the Aryans. And their influence in due course spread right the way down the south, the Sanskritic Brahmanical tradition, as it were. Now, the political essentialist argument is that actually the Indus Valley culture was Aryan. They spoke the Sanskrit, not the Dravidian language. And that this civilization goes back many thousands of years. Now, it's very difficult because actually there's an archaeological continuity in the Indus Valley from way back in the Neolithic period, right the way through to 2000 BC, even up to 1000 BC. Painted greyware is important in this continuity. So it looks... So the picture of the Aryan invasion has to be extremely modified, but perhaps arguably not altogether abandoned. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make, I think, is that the political essentialists argue that the Indus Valley was... the Vedas come from the Indus Valley, and the Vedas are indigenous. They don't come from outside of India, that's the point. And Hinduism grows out of this whole culture, and is indeed Aryan. Ascoparpola claims that the Indus Valley script is actually a Dravidian language. They found these seals with these what looks like an alphabet, looks like letters or wording on it, and he argues that he claims to have deciphered some of it, and claims that it's a Dravidian language related to Tamil. But recently, there's been some controversy about this, and recent scholarship seems to indicate that it's actually not actually a script, that it's a series of symbols. So Ascoparpola spent his life deciphering something which doesn't exist. So, well, who knows? It's a sad story, though, isn't it? It's funny at the same time. So, let's conclude then. There's a quote from Simon Waitman here, which I thought I'd end with. It is, "Hindu self-awareness and self-identity that affirms Hinduism to be one single religious universe, no matter how richly varied its contents, and which makes it a significant and potent force alongside other religions of the world." Well, he wrote that many years ago now, but... So, I leave it for you to assess in the coming weeks the validity of that claim. So, any questions or points you want to raise or disagreements?
No disagreement at all, but I thought your image of the pressure cooker is interesting, and maybe you could extend it to say that the steam that comes out of the top then, you know, sort of bursts out the sides, because of course lot of Indian culture goes to Southeast
Great.
Asia.
That would be in next year's lecture. That's right, it comes out the sides and goes, that's right, yeah.
Two things you mentioned about from Gita, it says, Pushpam Phalam Tvayam, that is,
flower,
fruit, and water. If anyone gives me that, I will be happy to bless them. Mm. That is from Gita. Mm. And in Gita it is also said, Chadur Varnim Maya Srishtam Unakarma Vibhagayo. On the basis of the intellect and also the work they do, I have divided the society into four, but I do not, I am not responsible for the way they function. Mm. So perhaps it is from that time the so-called caste system originated. Mm. You talked about Kerala. In Kerala, most of the temples are Devi temples. Mm. That is, Kali puja is very... And the other temples are Krishna and Shiva.
Yes.
Temples.
Yes, that's right.
And about Hindus eating meat, it goes back to Ramayana, when Rama, Lakshmana and Sita went to the forest. The first time they went, Rama killed the animal. So Hindus, that time, if they were called Hindus, then they were not vegetarians. Vegetarian habit came probably through the influence of Buddhism.
I think so too, I agree. Yeah. I suspect it comes from their own outset traditions.
But the Buddhist influence on Hinduism or vegetarianism is fine, but the Buddhists who went out of India,
yes,
they became non-vegetarians.
Yes.
They don't kill, but they eat if an animal is killed by somebody
else. That's right, yes. The colour, yes. Very interesting. I think that quote from the Gita, your first quote, is sums up the essence of puja, really, is making an offering, receiving a blessing. I think that's...
But again, Gita, it is said, ananya chindayam dhyomam yejana parivasade yesham ityabhiyuktanam yogakshemam pahamyam. Those who forget themselves and identify themselves with me and do everything for me, I will protect all the good that they have and I will give them more prosperity. Mm. That is also said in Gita.
So we'll be looking at some of those ideas in the coming weeks. And we'll be looking at Kerala in the week of 7.
This is just a question that when you do the Vedas, of the Vedas, as far as I know, there are three parts to it. The Samhita part, the Brahmana part, and the Upanishad part. If my personal study, I was told that Samhita is a revelation, so there are hymns. The Upanishad is also a revelation. Mm-hmm. But since the Brahmana part is more telling you how to do things and so on, are they regarded as revelations or just later introduced into the Vedic part?
There's different answers to that question. I think yes, briefly, but I'll be talking about it next week more. Because the term Veda is used for the Samhitas, as you say, but it's also sometimes used for the whole lot, you know, including the Upanishads. So there's an ambiguity over its use. Sorry, I've left the what I should have given you back in the office, I'm afraid, the reading for next week. Can you find that reading yourself, do you think? Or no, I'll bring it on next week and I'll hand it out and we'll refer to it in the class. So that would be the way to do it. So next week we're looking at the Vedas and the Upanishads, and I'll bring along the handout for you. Thanks. Antonia, before we disappeared, did we arrange to meet? I can't remember when it was.
Next
Wednesday. Oh, next Wednesday, okay.
That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Did you get that thing? Did you get that program?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think?
Good.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
So we're meeting Wednesday the 19th at 2.
That's one of
them.
Another one. 2004,
I think that's. Oh, brilliant. Oh, thanks so much. Yeah. Thanks very much. Thursday at 11:30. That's right, there we are.
So, could we meet later? Because
sure,
at 12, I have a lecture at 9.
Oh, sure, okay.
Or 3:30?
3:30 is fine. That's Thursday. That's tomorrow. Good. So I'm seeing you soon also today, aren't I? 3:00, yeah.
Oh, no, I'll see you.
Good heavens, I can expect something to happen to me. I've got to go about it. Oh, we're going to turn this off.
Thank you, that was great.
That makes sense, I know.
That was great.
Difficult to know how to pitch it, because I mean you've got Ken who knows a lot and you've got other people who haven't done anything.
But at the same time it's still an introduction, isn't it?
It's an introduction.
The only thing I don't know is many things I don't know, but what about the Dharma Artha? karma and moksha, karma karma. Sometimes I see it the other way around, karma artha, karma and moksha. Why is it that sometimes it's karma, karma, artha, moksha?
Yeah. I've seen different ways too. I think it's to do with whoever's writing, whoever's this is most important.
Hmm.
There's some debate about this, which is most important.
Yeah, Professor Gomrich used to always do it the other way, karma before the moksha.
Yeah, well, I do. Yeah.
It's the other way.